I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jim Cook, the founder of the Boston Beer Company, the maker of the popular Sam Adams brand. Sam Adams is considered among the higher quality premium beers in America, and the company is partly responsible for launching America's craft beer revolution. I want to start off by understanding the history of beer in America before we go into the history of Sam Adams.
Well, brewing and beer in the United States goes all the way back to the founding of this country. It was a necessary beverage for the original settlers. They tried to brew at Jamestown. When the Pilgrims came here from England, they provisioned the Mayflower with virtually no water. They provisioned it only with beer because beer was both sanitary and nourishing. So it was an important part of their hydration and their nutrition. And they actually ended up here in New England instead of further south where the weather was better because, as William Bradford, the diarist on the Mayflower, wrote, "We must make our landfall, our victuals are much spent, especially our beer."
Huh.
So the Pilgrims stopped here because they ran out of beer. And of the first presidents, three of the first five presidents were themselves brewers. And of course, George Washington not only had a brewery in Mount Vernon, but he left one of his beer recipes for a porter, which was a style that was very popular in the colonial days. His recipe's in the New York Public Library. And James Madison actually contemplated a proposal to establish a national brewery, just like a national bank. Brewing was that important to everyday life back in the 18th century.
So it was really a part of this country's cultural fabric.
Oh, very much. I mean, and of course, the sort of the founding father of American independence, the radical behind the American Revolution, was Samuel Adams.
Right.
And he was a brewer.
Mm-hmm.
And the revolution began in the taverns because they were Samuel Adams' customers, and they were also the gathering places where people shared ideas, got news from travelers from other places. In fact, Daniel Webster called the taverns the headquarters of the revolution.
Well said.
And Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence in part at the Indian Queen Tavern in Philadelphia, probably over a pot of nice beer.
Well, just as beer is a part of this nation's DNA, beer is part of your family's DNA. And I would love to know about the history of your family as it relates to beer.
Yeah, my family is obviously of German origin, since my name, though it's pronounced Cook, is spelled the German way, K-O-C-H. And my great-great-great-grandfather came over here from Germany, we believe, in around the 1840s, in a time of a lot of political turmoil in Central Europe. And he came here as a brewer, brought with him, as did a whole wave of other German immigrants. They came here with not only their immigrant drive and energy, but recipes for making a new kind of beer, at least new in the 1840s and 50s. It was called lager beer, and it was a beer that was aged longer periods of time, fermented at cooler temperatures, and this longer fermentation and aging gave the beer a smoother, mellower, more elegant taste. And America adopted these rich, smooth, flavorful lagers that came over here from Bavaria and Bohemia.
Now, was beer making your grandparents' primary vocation?
Yes. In fact, every oldest son in my family for six generations has been a brewmaster.
So you're legit.
All brewmasters.
You're legit.
Oh, yeah.
Now, your father, though, wasn't in the beer business ultimately. Why did he leave it?
Well, when my father got out of brewmaster school in 1948, there were nearly 1,000 breweries here in the U.S., and they were, you know, prospering, they were successful. by the time I started Samuel Adams in 1984, those 1,000 breweries had dwindled to about 35. So, you know, do the math, 95% of the brewmaster's jobs went away. And eventually, after he lost his job a few times, my father realized that he needed to find another way to make a living because he had 4 kids. And I think the last 6 months he worked as a brewmaster, he made $500. Mm. And that just wasn't enough even in those days.
What did he end up doing?
He eventually started his own business distributing first brewing chemicals and then other supplies for other manufacturing processes in Cincinnati, where I grew up.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jim Cook, the founder of the Boston Beer Company, which makes the popular brand Sam Adams. What did you think you were going to do for a living? Because your father seemed disenchanted by the economic realities of the beer industry.
Well, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I mean, I went to Harvard in the 60s and graduated in 1971, so it was a very different time, a very chaotic time. People really didn't make plans and careers as much as they do now. And I kind of postponed this whole commitment by going to a program that Harvard had. It was a joint JD MBA program where you could do Harvard Law School and Harvard Business School simultaneously. I managed to get through the first 2 years of it and realized, gee, I'm 24 years old. I've never really done anything in my life but go to school.
Right.
And now I'm being forced to make lifelong career choices without having any real life experience to make them on. And I got to get out of here before, you know, I end up going down some rabbit hole and never coming back. So I left Harvard behind and spent 3 years doing a bunch of things, including working as an instructor for Outward Bound, teaching mountaineering, kayaking, canoeing, basic climbing and other outdoor skills. And that was a great experience.
You maverick.
Well, at the time, it wasn't that crazy. You know, the mavericks were the ones who were sure they wanted to go be investment bankers and get rich.
So after your Outward Bound release, you went back to Harvard and you finished your JD MBA. And then what did you do?
I immediately decided I wasn't going to take the bar.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the summer off, and then I began working at a consulting firm here in Boston called Boston Consulting Group and ended up specializing in manufacturing companies.
At what point did you say, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to start making beer. Was there an epiphany moment? What led you to that point?
Well, there were a couple of things. I'd been doing this for 5 or 6 years, and I asked myself, do you want to do this for the rest of your life? And the epiphany was no. And having said, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life, the logical consequence was, well, I don't really want to do this tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I was 34 years old, so I thought, all right, I want to do something entrepreneurial. I want to do something small. I'd done okay financially at BCG, and so I didn't have huge financial needs. You know, I'd spent 3 years sleeping on the ground and living in a tent, so having a roof over my head seemed like plenty of luxury. So I was okay with that, and I thought maybe if I start a little local business that I really have passion for, that would be the best place where I could end up. It doesn't have to grow big, but it has to be something that I really want to do for the rest of my life. And in 20 years, I'll still be excited about getting up and doing this. And that had to be beer. You know, the best thing in life is to do the thing that your parents don't want you to do because they don't think you can pull it off. You know, they would love you to be successful at it, but they don't think you're going to be able to do that successfully. And then go ahead, do something that they doubt and turn your back on the safer thing that they want you to do and do the insane thing and pull it off. And that's there's nothing to make them happier.
Inherent in that comment is the idea that your dad didn't approve of this choice.
No,
is that
not
really
at all.
True?
You know, in some ways, he was right, because from his perspective, you know, getting into the beer business, this business that was grinding up every small brewery and had been doing that for decades, made absolutely no sense at all.
Right, but because you had your experience in corporate America consulting for all of these companies, you probably had a nuanced perspective about the beer industry. What was your view of the industry?
Yeah, it was very simple. My idea was to make great, flavorful beer here in the United States and give it to people fresh.
And why was that different?
No one was doing that. And if you go back to 1984, when I started Sam Adams, you could not get great, fresh, flavorful beer here in the United States. You had basically two choices. You could get the mass-produced American beers from the big breweries, the Bud, Miller, and Coors. And that beer is very well made. It's consistent. It's inexpensive. It's in many ways almost as flawless as McDonald's French fries. If you wanted a flavorful beer, you had to get an import. And if you know about beer and brewing, you realize that beer is like liquid bread. It has a shelf life. It doesn't last forever. It's good for 3, 4, 5 months, depending on the exact beer. And when I looked at what you got from the imports, they were typically stale. So you either got your mass-produced domestic beer, which wasn't flavorful, or you got imported beer, which was typically skunky and or stale, and no one was putting a really great fresh beer in front of the American beer drinker.
In fact, a year after you launched, you had your first ad campaign in 1986. Do you remember what that slogan was?
I think there was one that started out, "When America asked for Europe's tired and poor, we didn't mean their beer." And that was on the 100th anniversary of the Statue of Liberty.
My guest is Jim Cook, the founder of Boston Beer Company, the makers of the Samuel Adams brand. We'll hear more from Jim coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jim Cook, the founder of the Boston Beer Company, the maker of the popular Sam Adams brand. Sam Adams is considered among the higher quality premium beers in America, and the company is partly responsible for launching America's craft beer revolution. We're talking about the early days of the company, and I want to talk about capitalization. How did you raise money initially?
Well, when I had this idea to start a brewery here in Boston and to sell a kind of beer that nobody had ever tasted, except a few old-timers, I couldn't get money. I had to raise money from friends, from relatives.
Did your parents invest?
Yep, my dad invested.
How much, do you remember?
He invested, I think, $40,000. Mm-hmm. The whole company was started with $240,000. I had $100,000 of my own money. My dad put in 40, and then I had some friends and relatives who put in the rest and committed to a little more if I needed it. So it was started on a complete shoestring, but it was never meant to be what it became. I had no idea when I started brewing Samuel Adams that there would be this thirst for really good beer, and that Samuel Adams would be one of the pioneers of what has become an entire craft brewing revolution in the United States. I think none of us who started back then had any idea that we could change the face of small-scale brewing here in America.
So what were some of the first challenges that you faced after raising this $240,000? Where did you make the beer, for instance?
Well, you just have all these challenges when you're starting from nothing. I mean, I made the first batches of Samuel Adams in my kitchen because, you know, I knew how to brew. You can, in fact, home brew. It's really not that hard, though most people don't realize it. It's about as hard as making bread. I knew I needed proper equipment. I needed sanitation. I needed a lab. I needed quality control. And my dad said, well, that's not going to be a problem. I know other brewmasters. There's breweries in the Northeast that are not full. And we'll find one with the 19th century equipment that we need to make this recipe. And I found one in Pittsburgh. It was an old-fashioned 19th century brew house, and I started making my beer there.
So you figured out how to make the beer. Who agreed to buy the beer initially?
Well, that was another problem, because in beer, as in other alcoholic beverages, you have what's called a three-tier system. There are breweries who brew the beer, then there are distributors who distribute it, and then there are retailers who sell it. And they are three different licenses, and they're three different businesses. So here I was brewing the beer, so I went out and talked to the beer distributors in Boston, and there were five of them, and guess what? Every single one of them turned me down. 5 out of 5. Nobody had ever heard of Samuel Adams. They didn't know who I was. I had no money for advertising or marketing. The whole company was two people, me and a 23-year-old woman named Rhonda Kalman, who became a legend in the business, but at that time was a novice. And, you know, it was a beer that nobody had ever even tasted anything like this. So they all said, good luck, kid, but it's not for us.
What was your reaction? Did you feel discouraged, or did you say, you know what, they're wrong?
Oh, I knew that there was going to be a market for it. I just didn't know whether it was tiny or infinitesimal. So what I ended up doing is getting a distributor's license myself. And I thought, okay, well, I can rent a truck. I can, you know, rent a warehouse. And I'll go out there and I'll sell my beer. Mm-hmm. So I took my fancy consultant's briefcase and I took out all the papers and I put 2 blue cold packs in there and 6 bottles of Samuel Adams. And I went from bar to bar selling my beer. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the week, I would get on the truck and deliver it.
And who was your first account?
My first account was in Boston. It was on State Street, which is the same street that Samuel Adams had his brewery on. It was called the Dockside. And I was so excited when I got the order that I forgot to ask him, how many cases do you want? So I had to go back the next day and with a little sheepish look and say, geez, I'm really excited that you're going to carry my beer. I hope you don't change your mind. How many cases do you want?
In retrospect, do you think you were better off by having the 5 distributors turn you down than if they had said, okay, we'll distribute you?
Yeah, it was in retrospect. It didn't seem like it at the time because it was very scary to go from being this, you know, high-powered, high-paid management consultant to a beer salesman. It got me out of this hermetic, you know, prestigious atmosphere where you're, you know, treated really well, you're working with CEOs, you're flying first class and staying in nice hotels, and being kicked out of that and one day and get out onto the street with beer in my briefcase, that was very humbling. And as a beer salesman, you're walking into a bar. They don't know you from Adam. They don't need you. They may not even want to talk to you. And all of a sudden, you know, you need these people. And I was very lucky. The bartenders and the bar managers and the owners of Boston kind of took pity on me. They took me under their wing. You know, they gave me a break. I'd have people, you know, they'd taste the beer and they'd look at me and they'd go, kid, I liked your story. I liked what you're doing, but I didn't think the beer was going to be this good. I'll put it in for you.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jim Cook, the founder of the Boston Beer Company, which makes Sam Adams. In addition to having local success in the Northeast, you also very early on had some international success. You moved quite quickly into West Germany, or what at the time was West Germany. You started the company in 85. When did you move into West Germany?
That summer, a guy who lived in Munich, who was in business there and who I had known before, heard about Sam Adams, heard about this great beer, and called me and said, "Jim, we can sell this beer in Germany. I want to be your importer." So I gave him the rights to Germany, and we sent the beer over there, and it passed the German beer purity law, which and began to be imported into Germany, and that had never happened before. We were the first American beer imported into Germany after passing this German beer purity law. So they'd never had an American beer.
What was the German purity law called?
Oh, it's called the Reinheitsgebot.
And how old was it?
It dates back to actually the 15th century. It was formulated in Munich in the 1490s, and then it became a decree that applied to all of Bavaria in 1516.
So you were an international company.
Yeah, we were actually in Germany before, you know, we were in Brighton.
And then in 1986, you had another lucky moment in that Sam Adams was accepted in the White House and it was found on Air Force One. How does that happen to a 35-year-old entrepreneur making great beer?
It was very cool. There was someone who I had known, and she'd moved down to D.C. and she was buying a house, and somehow she was talking to the realtor about this beer, the Samuel Adams beer, and how good it was. And the realtor said, "Well, that's really interesting. My husband manages the provisioning of beer for the White House." And
wow.
It's the funniest thing. It's this little office in the basement of the White House. So I went there with my cold beer and my two blue cool packs. I brought cold Sam Adams into this office, which is, because it's managed by the Navy, it's called the White House Mess. So there was an office in the White House that said the White House Mess. No wonder they put it in the basement. And the guy tasted it and he said, "This is great. You know, we don't have a beer like this here. We have people coming from all these foreign countries, and a lot of them make fun of American beer. We'll put a Sam Adams in front of them. That'll shut them up."
Wow. So what, by the way, was going on in your personal life at the time? Were you single? Were you married? And talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah, it was a very sort of turbulent time for me because in my personal life, when I started the business, I ended up in divorce for a lot of reasons. And so you know, I was a divorced father. I had two kids, so I was juggling, you know, the time with my children, with the business. So it worked out okay, but I can tell you I didn't spend a lot of time watching TV.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jim Cook, the founder of the Boston Beer Company, which makes the popular brand Sam Adams. I want to talk about your partner in all of this in the early days. What was her name?
Her name was Rhonda Kalman.
How did you meet her?
Rhonda and I worked together at Boston Consulting Group. She had been my secretary there, but she was clearly very, very talented. And Rhonda knew bars. I mean, she was young. She was single. She liked to go out at night. She'd actually been a bartender. She knew how a bar worked. God love her, she decided to take a chance and help me start Sam Adams. And she, over the next 15 years, built up the sales force. She was our head of sales, head of marketing. She was a very important part of the company for many years.
I guess in the early days, you did very grassroots marketing, going door to door. But then how did you step it up from there?
After we got picked as the best beer in America, I thought, well, that's pretty cool. Why don't I start to tell people about that? Because it'll change the way they think about beer. And the only thing that I could afford at that point was local radio here in Boston. And I couldn't afford real talent. You know, I couldn't afford a radio voice because it was too expensive. So I started doing the commercials myself. You know, I'd walk into a studio and I'd write out a 60-second sort of educational piece about beer. And there was so much that people didn't know about beer that it was very easy just spinning these commercials out one after another.
So it was through necessity that you became the spokesman for the company to some degree. I see other owners of brands who are taking more ownership, so to speak, of the marketing. You look at Kentucky Fried Chicken, or what are some other brands where the CEO or the founder is attached to?
When I started, Lee Iacocca had done a very good job convincing American car buyers that, you know, that Chrysler was back, and certainly with a very small brewery like Sam Adams. And, you know, even now, after being successful beyond any of my dreams, our market share is still about 0.5%. You know, we're 1/200th of the beer market in the United States. And when you're that small, I think it is comforting for people to know that there is a real person behind this beer, and I'm still committed to the quality. And I think that was a message that resonated.
One manifestation of the importance of quality to you was this this expiration date being put on the bottles. Was that your idea? How did that happen?
It was very simple. When that bottle of Sam Adams leaves the brewery, it can be the best beer in America. But if the consumer drinks it when it's stale, it's not good beer. And my feeling was, if it's a stale bottle of Sam Adams, I don't want people to buy it. And today, you know, we destroy several million dollars worth of stale Sam Adams. But I make a point, one of the things I've always done is every year we put 1,000 gallons of stale Sam Adams in a dunk tank, and I go into that dunk tank to raise money for charity. And to me, it's a great way of making the point that I'd rather put people into stale beer than stale beer into people.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jim Cook, the founder of the Boston Beer Company, which makes the popular brand Sam Adams. How do you know whether a beer is high quality or not? Can you tell by looking at it?
No, it's the whole experience that all of your senses get. But it basically is as simple as ABC. A great beer will have a lot of flavor. B, not only will it have a lot of flavor, but it'll be balanced. And that balance will be between the body and sweetness of the malt and the spiciness and bitterness of the hops. And C, not only will it have a lot of flavor and be balanced, but it'll be complex. There'll be a lot going on in your mind. It'll be almost symphonic in all the different flavor notes. And that's a great beer.
What is the white stuff on top of the beer called? Not the foam, but the head or something?
Yeah, the head.
The firmer the head, isn't a firm head indicative of a high-quality beer?
Typically. The foam on a beer, the head on a beer is protein. And an all-malt beer like Sam Adams that doesn't have corn or rice or other adjuncts will have a dense, almost creamy foam to it. Now, there are other ways of getting the same thing. You know, there are chemical stabilizers that have been used in the past. You can inject nitrogen. So it's not a perfect correlation, but yes, a really good beer should have a dense, rocky, almost creamy head on it. And in fact, in one of my radio commercials, I used to tell people, which is still true, that Sam Adams has a head so thick you can float a bottle cap on it.
And by the way, that noise was Jim opening a bottle of Sam Adams.
Just to prove that, yes, there is truth in what you hear on the radio. I open the bottle. I'm going to float the Sam Adams bottle cap There on the head.
And
there
it's staying put.
Just like a happy little boat floating on this foamy sea.
How many different types of beer do you offer?
Well, we officially say 18, but it's really more than that. In the course of a year, there's probably 30 different styles of Samuel Adams beer that we will brew.
By the way, I have a friend who particularly enjoys your chocolate Bock.
Ah, you have a good friend there. That was a very fun beer to make because chocolate is an interesting ingredient. It's very, very flavorful. It's a very complex food with lots of quality difference. And we had to figure out how to get the ingredient at what stage in the chocolate making process. So we ended up basically selecting cocoa nibs, which is the form in which the raw material, the raw ingredient leaves the farm in Ghana. We got it right out of the farm before it really had been processed. And then we put it in the beer at the end and steep it for a month in this long, slow, cold infusion in alcohol and water that just draws the pure essence of the chocolate out of those cocoa nibs.
By the way, I just want to explain a visual. Throughout this whole conversation, you have been so physical and gesticulating with your eyes closed and so passionate. I just needed to share that with listeners because they're not able to see the feast of my eyes.
Well, Jessica, I was tasting the chocolate Bock in my mind and I was remembering the ingredients and feeling them and tasting them. So it's a really rich kind of experience for me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, if you've got the time, I got the beer.
My guest has been Jim Cook, founder of the Boston Beer Company, makers of Samuel Adams. Coming up, we'll meet Simon Pierce, the glass blower and founder of the glass company, Simon Pierce. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Simon Pierce, a glassblower, potter, and founder of Simon Pierce, a company that sells high-quality glass, furniture, and pottery for the home. Simon is a hands-on craftsman who started selling his glass in rural Ireland in the 1960s. Even today, he generates his own electricity, builds his own furnaces, and makes all of his glass by hand. Simon Pierce has an international presence, including 12 retail stores in San Francisco and on the East Coast of the United States. Simon, can you please describe your business and tell me how your interest in glass originated?
Well, the emphasis on things to use on the table. And it all started, well, it started with pottery because my father was a potter and he made functional pottery. I did pottery for a number of years and then I switched to glass because nobody was making glass of the kind that I really liked, which had the same character as the pottery, which had a handmade feeling, like the early English rummers and the French rummers of 150 years ago. I used to buy them in junk shops for 50 cents in those days. They've now become sort of collector's pieces, and they're more expensive. But they had a very simple, a beautiful simplicity about them, a real feeling of handmade, which I really liked. And so that's how I got into the glass business.
Where was this? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in County Cork, in the southeast of Ireland. My father moved there when I was 4 years old. And contrary to what everyone believes, I'm not Irish. I actually have no Irish blood. My mother was Welsh and my father was English, and I was born in London. But we moved there when I was four, and Ireland's the country that feels like my home. My father was actually a very interesting man because his father started a printing works in London, but he really didn't want to live in London. And he discovered this little village. The story goes, he got the ferry to Cork and he had his bicycle with him and he rode it down 20 miles to this village called Shanagarry and stayed with some friends he'd been given the name of. And he was meant to stay for afternoon tea and he stayed for the rest of his life.
He seems to have had an adventurous spirit, just getting off the ferry and taking his bike and deciding he wanted to live there. Do you feel like you have some of that adventurous spirit in you?
Yeah, I probably have too much of it in me. It's interesting now you say that, where it comes from, but we definitely had that adventurous spirit. And I was very dyslexic, which nobody knew at that time in Ireland, and I really was never meant to be at school. It just didn't work, you know, school and I just didn't agree. And I'd keep running away, and they'd keep sending me back. And it's actually an interesting story. I kept saying to my parents, I want to leave school. And they said, well, you can't leave school. You know, you have to go to school. And I kept doing, every summer I'd say, I want to leave school. And finally they said, okay. And I was 15, and, you know, I was halfway through high school. And I thought, wow, that was easy. You know, that's amazing. I hadn't really expected them to say yes, but they did. And I spent a year at home working in the pottery, and then I went off to New Zealand to learn to make pottery when I was 16. When I came home a few years later, when I was 21, I was sitting opposite my father at a dinner party, and I overheard him say to the person beside him, when Simon was expelled from school, and I had never known till that moment that I actually had been expelled. They hadn't just let me leave. They'd had to let me leave, but they'd never told me.
What a sign of your parents trying to instill a sense of confidence in their dyslexic son. They were followers of this educator named A.S. Neal, who advocated a form of education allowing your children to do anything they wanted. Can you explain that a little more?
He basically believed in the child and believed that the children who were having problems or in trouble just weren't really being helped find their path. And so in his school, you didn't have to go to school. You literally never had to go to a class at Summerhill. And he found that the kids, he really wanted to go to school. But if you forced them and if you made them, it didn't work. And they pretty much ran the school. They made all the rules. They decided, you know, how people should be punished or if they should and when. And it was a very extraordinary place.
And how did that manifest itself as a child? Are there any anecdotes that you can recall?
Yeah, my parents basically brought us up like that. We had an extraordinary level of freedom, always. They believed in letting the child find the limits. In other words, they never said, don't touch, don't do that, don't go there. There was virtually no don'ts. One day I wanted to go up to the chimney, and I was, I think, 8 years old. And it was quite a steep slate roof. My mother couldn't bear to watch me do this, but she couldn't stop me either. She didn't want to stop me. So she got in the car and left while I climbed out the skylight and climbed up onto the top of the roof and looked out, you know, over the bay or whatever I wanted to do and came down. But that was the degree to which they believed that we should find our own limits and barriers. To me, that seemed absolutely normal. And today, here in this country, you'd probably be arrested, you know,
child negligence.
Child negligence or something.
Have you translated that philosophy onto your own family?
I would say we had very much the same parenting skill. We did it the same way. I think we toned it down a bit, so our life as parents was not quite as crazy as my parents.
Or as miserable, perhaps?
Or as miserable. I mean, they had some tough times with us because it's not an easy philosophy to execute.
What I also found interesting about your parents was not only instilling the sense of self-confidence and adventure, but they also placed an emphasis on the products that you used in your home. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was really what their sort of life centered around was, I think, beautiful objects and beautiful things. And music. My father he loved classical music and books because he had an antiquarian bookstore at one point. But they had this sort of philosophy that everything you used should be thought about. In other words, you didn't just buy something without taking some trouble to look at it and make sure that it was something you really wanted and really liked and that was really beautiful. And that didn't mean the things were expensive. I mean, I'm talking about things like egg cups, every little detail.
In a way, that whole emphasis portended or foreshadowed your interest in pottery and glass. Was it more through osmosis, or did you sort of have an epiphany moment where you said, I want to be a potter and a glass blower, and I want to make a business of this?
No, it was much more through osmosis. I always knew I'd do something with my hands. That I don't know why, but from a very early age, I knew that I would work with my hands. And I think at that age, I wanted to try something different and different than what my father had done. That was at that same time I started collecting that early glass that I liked so much. So that's how the two kind of came along.
My guest is Simon Pierce, a glassblower, potter, and founder of Simon Pierce, a company that sells high-quality glass furniture and pottery for the home. How do you then turn this interest in glass into a business?
It was very hard to get into the business. I wrote to 15 companies in Europe, and most of them never applied, and the ones that did said no. Glass was just beginning in Europe in those days, studio glass. There was only one school in England called the Royal College of Art that had a glass department. And it turned out that a friend of ours was on the board of the Royal College, and she introduced me to the professor who ran it. And my belief had been if I was went to a college, you know, I'd never learn the skill. But it was the only option I had. And the professor at the time said he'd take me on for a year. And I was right. If I'd been there for 50 years, I never would have learned to blow glass. But it acted as a great stepping stone, you know, and I've always been very grateful to him for giving me that opportunity to at least get in somewhere. So then I went to the Rietveld Academy in Amsterdam. And then one of the professors there said, well, you should go down to Leerdam, which is a famous glass factory. And that's where I discovered the secret of getting into glass factories. You just go and you arrive and you talk to the foreman, not the top people who run it. That was where I got my first reel in. And I worked in that factory for 3 months with their master glassmaker as his assistant, just his gopher. And then I went down to Venice and got into a glass factory there called Venini, which is one of the famous Italian factories, and worked there for 3 months. And my job there was at about 6 in the morning when they started. I would go out to the local store and buy liters of white wine and liters of Coca-Cola and mix them 50-50. That's what they would drink from 6 o'clock in the morning until they staggered out of there at about 2 in the afternoon.
What is one called, that concoction?
Well, it doesn't have a name that I know of, but it was great for the thirst and it kept everyone happy. And they were the most skillful glassmakers I've ever seen anywhere. They were making the most incredibly elaborate pieces, unbelievable.
So how old were you during all this time? Were you in your teens?
I was about 19 when I was in doing that.
So then at what point do you say, okay, I'm ready, I have enough experience and expertise, I'm going to go back home to Ireland and open up my own shop?
Well, it had been 2 years since the time I started at the Royal College and I finished in Scandinavia. So it was 2 years. I got my inheritance from my father, which was $10,000. The Irish government gave me some help, and they had a small business loan, which I got from them. And so I put it all together and built this factory. This factory was a small workshop, really. I was interested in making functional glass, simple, beautiful, functional glass for everyday use. I wasn't interested in making art glass, one-of-a-kind pieces. But an interesting antidote, on my way back from Europe, I'd made a whole lot of samples of the sort of glass I wanted to make. And they were pretty basic and crude and so on, but I was very proud of them and I thought they were beautiful. And I went to London and I went to see the buyer at the General Trading Company and Liberty's, and I think it was Harrods was the other one, you know, and I proudly showed them my ware and said, you know, and they said, oh no, our customers would never be interested in something as basic or as crude as that, you know, that we'd never have a market for that. So that kind of deflated me a little bit. But anyway, I went back to Ireland and set up my workshop because I still believed, and I had enough friends who I knew were giving me honest feedback. The interesting thing about that is within 5 years, once I got going and we got a lot of publicity because I think that it was so unusual what we were doing in the very early days. All three stores came back looking for the product and never having realized that I had visited them or they had been turned me down. You know, there was that sort of disconnect. Once you've been written about and there's something, people think there's something special about what you're doing, then people change. It's amazing how that happened. But so I was trying to do, as everybody does when they start as their first small business, everything. And I blew glass every day, but I'd be up all night with the furnaces trying to get the glass to melt. And I was also trying to run the business. You mean trying to get the orders and trying to sell the product? And
how were you at the business? Because you had focused so much on the craft side of things. Did you like the business component, or did your father instill some sort of business acumen in you?
One of the things that I felt was really special about him was that he really enjoyed both parts of the business. He really enjoyed making pottery and all aspects of the making. And he also really enjoyed the business. He really enjoyed keeping his books, even though there was kind of one little ledger, but he really enjoyed that. And he really enjoyed dealing with the customers, and he really enjoyed selling the product. He had incredibly good business principles, like he was never late with an order. If you ordered something and he said you'll have it in 3 weeks, you had it in 3 weeks. And so I observed those growing up, and it was a great, great advantage, because I think many craftspeople would have a much easier life if they enjoyed the business side. But there's kind of this thing that we craftspeople can pick up, which is that the business is kind of a dirty word, you know. If you're into making things, beautiful things, then the business and making things don't really go together. But in fact, once you make something and sell it, you're in business. Whether you like it or not, you're in business.
Luckily, you did enjoy both sides, the craft and the business. How does your business then end up on the other side of the Atlantic in New England?
I was getting frustrated running the business in Ireland. There was a lot of things in those days that made it very difficult. And a lot of the basic services didn't work very well, like the phone and the post office and the taxes. So I just was getting very frustrated. It was after 10 years and the business was finally beginning to work financially. It took about 8 years for it to break even, and I decided to move to America.
And why did America appeal to you as a place to open up your business?
Because all my dealings with Americans, and we'd exported quite a bit of glass, and I say to small accounts, small amounts, but quite a few around the country, and all my dealings with Americans had been incredibly straightforward, and they did business, it seemed, the way I liked doing business, which was, you know, you just do what you say you're going to do and you get on with it. And I love New England. I love Vermont. And I loved the feeling of the country up there. And
were there things that were more difficult than you had expected initially?
Yes, there were. The only thing that was really threw me for a loop was the cost of doing business. And that was a real struggle. The things we didn't really have to do in Ireland, or didn't cost much if you did do them, like use lawyers and have insurance. All those sort of basic things that people use a lot of in this country and you have to use in business here, and health insurance and all those, we didn't have those.
And where did you set up shop in Vermont when you came?
We found this extraordinary woolen mill. It's an old brick woolen mill on a river in Vermont in a village called Queechy. And it's absolutely a spectacular sight. And the moment I saw it, I fell in love with it. I had a strong sense that Queechy would work, looking at the map and where it is in relationship to Boston and the major highways and all the tourists that come up for the summers and fall and so on. And it was just an extraordinarily beautiful sight.
It is. I've been. And what are your total sales?
Total sales are about 30 million.
And when you first came to the United States, which was when? In
1971.
What were your sales once you got the mill off the ground?
I can't remember exactly, but I think we probably did about 100,000. You know, I can remember it took us about 5 years to break a million. And I thought that was, you know, the moon. I never in my wildest dreams thought we would do $1 million in sales. Well, no, not quite. It doesn't work like that. I always remember when the Irish Times wrote an article about me after we'd set up here, and they talked about the Irish millionaire. And I said, well, only in Ireland would they call somebody a millionaire who owes $1 million. It was a bit of everything. And it was that the retail store in Queechy was really the bedrock of the whole business. I wanted to make it a destination, almost an educational destination, where people could really come and see the product being made and use it, eat off it in the restaurant, drink out of it. So we had a glass making, we had the pottery, and we had the restaurant, and we had the retail store, where people could not only see it, but touch it. I always have a hard time with parents who tell their children not to touch the glass, because I love the children to touch the glass. And the children never break the glass. It's the parents who break all the glass. Mm-hmm. You know, they knock it off with their handbags or so on. But so
you should have a sign saying, children, please touch.
Yeah, we should have a sign saying that. because to me, it's, and that goes back to my mother and the education where, you know, the message you send to the child when you tell them not to touch, I think, is a really, really negative message. Because you're really telling the child it's not smart enough to pick this glass up without breaking it. And I think that it's a very, very strong message if from the time the child is born until it's an adult, it's being told, no, you can't do this, you can't do that, because you're not smart enough to pick it up without breaking it, which is... So, anyway, I shouldn't go off on my educational things.
Well, no, for those parents listening, I think they might want a lesson or two from Simon Pierce. Incidentally, you have a purple, it looks like a purple flower as your logo. What is that, that purple flower?
What that is, it's called a puntal mark. And when you make the glass and blow it, there's two ways to finish it. The way they used to finish it 100 years ago, which is you put a you attach it to another rod on the bottom, and you break the glass off the blowing iron, so it's now supported by this rod, which is called a puntal iron. It's a French word. And you heat up the rim in a little furnace called a glory hole, and you hand finish the rim. And that's how we finish most of our glass. And it also leaves this mark, which is our trademark, which is the puntal mark.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome. It was a real pleasure to be with you.
My guest has been Simon Pierce, the founder of Simon Pierce, a company that makes handmade pottery and glass for the home. If you'd like to listen to the show online, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com. If you have questions or comments about the show or about an endeavor you're trying to get off the ground, please email us at talk@fromscratchradio.com. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.